two colleagues met in the office one Monday morning, and neither of them particularly wanted to be there. And one said to the other, "You said, you know what? I bet you I can get the boss to give me the day off today." And the other said, "I'd like to see that." He said, "Watch this." And he climbed up the wall and hung himself upside down from the ceiling. And just then the boss walked in and said, "What do you think you're doing?" And the man said, "I'm a light bulb." The boss gave him a funny look and he said, "You're obviously not well. Go home and take the rest of the day off." As he walked out the door, his mate started following him. And the boss said, "And where do you think you're going?" He said, "Well, you don't expect me to work in the dark, do you?" Over the next few weeks, we're going to have a little short series. We're going to have a look at what the Bible says about work. And work is a huge part of our lives, isn't it? We're all different, but on average, it's been calculated that we spend 52% of our lives either at work or travelling to and from work or doing other work-related activities. That's more than half your life you will spend at work. And then, of course, there's all those other things that are also work that we do outside of the office and the 9-to-5. One phrase that we use to describe work is nose to the grindstone. I've never tried it. I imagine it would be painful. But it's interesting, isn't it? When we talk about work, we use phrases like that that basically spell out we see this as an unpleasant and a painful thing that we have to do. No wonder then that some people will go to extraordinary lengths to get out of work. The question is, as Christians, how ought we to feel about and understand work? And our starting point today is to look at the positive fact that when God created us, he created us to work. We often think of work as a necessary evil or something that's become part of life that we wish we could avoid it. But actually, the story of creation says that we were put here to work. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 and 28, we're told, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." Next verse, "And God blessed them. And God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on earth.'" I think there's a connection, a clear connection between those two verses. That is, in verse 27, we're given the fact God made us in his image. Verse 28, we're told a little bit of what the implications of that is. That is, as God's image bearers, part of our role is to care for his world, his creation. There are three words that are used there. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. Fruitful, multiply, one idea. Fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over it. I think some of that we've done very well at as a human race. Being fruitful and multiplying and filling the earth, we've done very well at. Nobody quite knows, other than God himself, what the carrying capacity of the earth is. That is, the number of people that it can actually manage to sustain and have live on it. Estimates vary. Did some reading this week. Estimates vary between 4 and 16 billion people. The current population of the earth is about 8 billion people. So we have either already passed and it's growing exponentially, we have already either passed or are heading rapidly towards the limits of what the earth can contain and provide for. So we've done well at being fruitful and multiplying and filling the earth. Big tick for us in that box. What about subduing it, having dominion over it? What does that mean? And how well have we done that? The language that's used there is the language of mastery over, having responsibility for, looking after it, being wise and faithful managers. Doesn't encourage us to exploit it or to waste it, but to look after it and care for it and rule over it. And now, I don't know about you, but I'm not entirely sure we've done that well at that part of the job. But the fact remains that God put us here in the first place, at least in part. There's more to it, but at least in part of being in the image of God is that we are his agents in looking after his world. We are now living in our own home again. For a number of years, we had it rented out. Part of that is, well, do we have agents or do we just rent it out privately? You may have had to work through those things too. Frankly, you have to pay an agent, yes, I know, but when the pipes burst in the middle of the night or the roof starts leaking in the storm, do you really want tenants ringing you and saying you need to come over and fix this? Well, it's kind of nice to have an agent that they ring them instead and they take care of it, and then you just get the message the next day, the pipes burst and we've had it fixed and the bill will be in the mail. That's what we have agents for, isn't it? To look after the place for us. It's ours, but they're looking after it for us. They're taking some of the burden off us, taking responsibility for us. And the Genesis tells us that it's God's world, but part of our role here is to be his agents, to look after his world. The work that we do, and I'm not just talking the 9-to-5 in the office, all those other things, the gardening and all the other things that we do, at least in part, is part of our responsibility in looking after this world that God has made and given us responsibility for. And I think we haven't got time for it today, but there's a whole question there about whether Christians should be environmentalists. I'm not suggesting we should all vote for the Greens, but I think we ought to think through what our attitude towards the environment is and the world that we live in is, because God gave us this responsibility in the first place. The second thing that we're told in Genesis is that our work is not just to look after God's world, but to provide for ourselves. In chapter 2, we're told a very similar thing. This time is the narrower context of the Garden of Eden. And verse 15, we're told the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden. 2, similar language, work it and keep it. Next verse again, and there's a connection, I think. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, you may surely eat of every tree of the garden. Well, except for the one, and we know that story. But look at what God says. He says, your job is to look after this garden, work it and keep it. And then as it flourishes and produces fruit, what's it for? It's for you. It's for you to eat. So the work that we were doing in God's world is not just to look after his world, but it's to provide for ourselves. There was a similar message in chapter 1, verse 29. God said to them, behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that's on the face of the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. So God says, here, look after this garden and it's going to produce fruit for you. Work and you will feed off what you grow. We work in order to provide for ourselves, to provide for our families. And so we had that reading from Thessalonians in which Christians are urged to see it as an important thing to do, to work, to provide for yourself and your family, because this is the part of the way that God has made us to be. And it's not just providing for ourselves and our own family, is it? We need to be able to look out for others. 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul writes to Timothy, verse 17, and he says, as for the rich in this present age, and if you're sitting there going, well, that's not me, I've got news for you, it is, compared to most of the world's population, we're right up there in the top handful of percent. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, not to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. Part of our work is not just to provide for ourselves, but to be able to help and provide for others. And I think we actually remind ourselves of that every Sunday. One of the things we do when we have the offertory, yes, we give money towards the work of the church, but what else comes up with the offertory? Basket. Do you ever look at the person carrying it and there's the basket case this morning? No. The basket comes forward, and what's in the basket? That's goods that you've donated to go to Anglicare to help feed those less fortunate than ourselves. It's one small example, and we do it in other ways. It's one small example in which we say we understand that our attitude towards the possessions that we have worked for is not just for ourselves, thank God I've got a full pantry at home, but to be able to provide generously for the needs of others less fortunate. So our work is looking after God's world. It's looking after ourselves and those around us. And it's not just a chore. We often think of work as a chore, as hardship. But it's actually something we're supposed to enjoy. Ecclesiastes in chapter 2 says this, "There is nothing better for a person than that he or she should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment?" Twice, talking about work, twice, Ecclesiastes says you should find enjoyment in it. I see some quizzical looks around the room. Clearly some people have not always found that to be the case. And we will talk next week about how it is that sometimes it goes so horribly wrong and work becomes a curse rather than a blessing. But it's interesting, isn't it? Ecclesiastes says, in principle at least, work is supposed to be something that you enjoy, find pleasure in. Why? I think it goes back to Genesis 1, where it tells us we're made in the image of God, and at the very heart of God is this creativity. What is God doing in Genesis 1? He is creating the world, the universe, and that the Bible calls his work. The work of creating is what God does, and when he makes us in his image, he makes us to be like him, that is, to be creative beings. And I think that's why Ecclesiastes sees that God has given us toil, work, that we might be able to not only provide for ourselves, but enjoy it. Have you ever found yourself in a position where you couldn't work? Yeah, at least one honest person here. I spent 6 weeks recently where I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. And at first you sort of go, excellent, I've been told I have to sit there and do nothing for 6 weeks and keep my arm still. Think of all the movies that I can watch, all the catching up I can do, and all those shows that everybody talks about and I've never seen. Can I tell you, it gets boring very quickly indeed. After a while, I thought, I've got to do something. What can I do? I can't use my arm. I started doing jigsaw puzzles. I don't think I've done a jigsaw puzzle. Oh, goodness knows how many years. But I did a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle of a 17th-century map of the world, and then I did a 1,500-piece jigsaw puzzle of a map of Middle Earth. Janina, yeah, it'll get off the dining table soon, darling, I'm sure. And I can tell you, doing a jigsaw puzzle, one piece at a time, with the wrong hand, that's very unco, is not a lot of fun. But it was better than doing nothing, because it's inherent in us to want to do stuff, to be doing something constructive, something creative. Number of retirees I've talked to who, after a lifetime of work, and we all sort of look forward to retirement, oh, thank goodness I'll be able to stop one day. And when they do, you know what they say? I'm bored. I don't know what to do with myself. I need to be doing something. And it's not just that it's sort of been ingrained in me by the system. No, it's been ingrained in me by God. And it doesn't mean I have to be doing paid work 9 to 5 at the office. It could be gardening. It could be helping out at the men's shed. It could be volunteering at the surf club or the scouts or at church. There's a multitude of things that we can do, but it's in our nature to be doing stuff, to be working and finding satisfaction and fulfillment in our work. If you won the lottery, what would you do? Apart from give it all to St. John's for the building program, I know. Maybe pay off your mortgage. Maybe take a holiday. Probably spend some of it unwisely. Do you know what a lot of lottery winners do? They go back to work. A couple of years ago, Kevin Jones, who's a bus driver from Cheshire in the UK, won £6 million. That's about $10 million, give or take. 5:30 the next morning, he was up and getting dressed and going off to drive the bus. Also in the UK, John Doherty, who was a plumber, and I've talked to some plumbers, and it's not a glamorous job, because it's not all just fixing kitchen taps. There are other things that you have to deal with. He won £14 million. He took the next day off, and the day after that, he was back fixing toilets. And someone from the media asked him why, and you know what he said? I was bored at home. Now, yes, of course, sometimes work can be hard and it can be frustrating, and we will take an honest look at that next week. And yes, it's true also that it's a biblical principle that we should also rest, that we should have a day of rest, and that ultimately heaven we look forward to as rest from the labours of this world. But it's true to say that we were created to work, and we need to work, not just as a responsibility of caring for God's world, and not just as a responsibility of providing for ourselves and our families, but as an expression of our inherent nature as creative beings made in the image of God. So I don't know what work faces you this week, but let me ask you, will you go out into the week ahead dreading having to go to work, thinking maybe if I pretend to be a light bulb, I'll get the day off? Or will you see it as an opportunity to serve God in his world, an opportunity to provide for yourself and your family and those in need around you, and a way to express the creativity that is inherent in your nature as a child of God? So there was this guy who had a real problem sleeping. I don't know if you have a problem sleeping. You know, if you don't sleep very well, you wake up in the morning tired, and the less sleep you get, more tired you are, the later you tend to wake up in the morning. Well, he was waking up every morning tired, sleeping late, which meant that he got to work late, which meant that the boss was getting crankier and crankier with him. So one day, his boss said, "You've got to do something about this." So he went to the doctor and he got a prescription for some pills to help him sleep. And that night he went to bed and he slept better than he had slept in a very long time. He woke up early, thought that he'd gone off feeling fresh and alive. He had breakfast, a leisurely breakfast for once, and he drove to work and got there on time, with a big smile on his face for the first time in months. And he walked in, and the boss summoned him into the office, and he looked at him and he said, "What happened to you?" The man said, "Oh, it's fantastic. I went to the doctor, I got these pills, I slept. I feel so good this morning." And the boss said, no, "I don't mean what happened to you with the doctor, I mean what happened to you yesterday." I don't know if you've ever slept a whole day and a night away like that and missed work. And if you did miss a day at work, how guilty would you feel about that? Would you feel bad at all? As I said, we're taking a little look at the Bible's view of work last week. We saw we were created to work. Why it is that work has turned into a curse rather than a blessing. So first, a quick recap. Genesis chapters 1 and 2, we were created to work. We were given the responsibility to care for and to rule over God's creation. And a lot of people, I think, when they think about the Garden of Eden, think, well, it must have been a little bit like being on a cruise. Not that I've ever been on a cruise, but I sort of imagine you're lying there in a deck chair on the deck and you're doing nothing, and if you want a drink, maybe a waiter will bring it or something. You've got absolutely nothing to do. Everything is taken care of. It's just a matter of relaxing and enjoying it. Is that what the Garden of Eden was like? Were Adam and Eve just sort of lying there on the soft, mossy ground, just waiting for the latest ripened peach to drop into their hands? And of course, if it dropped a little bit too far, I'm going to get out of the bottle and go and get that one. I'll just wait for the next one to fall a little bit closer. Is that what life was like in the Garden of Eden? No, we're told. Mankind, from the beginning, had to work. They had to tend the gardens. They had to forage for food. They had to be resourceful and use their ingenuity. They were living in to thrive and to feed themselves and provide for themselves and others. And this was good. Remember when God looked on all that he had made after creation and mankind was there and in place, God said, "It is very good." Work was not an evil thing that they resented. It was rewarding and it was good. But then in chapter 3 of Genesis, everything changed. You know the story, tempted by the serpent, Adam and Eve ate from a tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and suddenly everything was different. For the first time, they felt shame and fear. They hid from each other, and they hid from God. And God comes and he announces curses or punishment or consequences for everyone involved, for the serpent and for both Adam and Eve. The serpent was cursed to belly and eat dust. I always wondered what
snakes were like before. Did they have legs? So they, which we call them lizards? Or is it just metaphorical? It's saying, you, the evil one, are now cursed to grovel and be humiliated and be at constant war with mankind and eventually be crushed. That's your lot. That's your future. For the woman, he said, your relationship with your husband will be fraught with tension, and bringing children into the world will be a hard and a painful experience. I'm only a father, and it's hard and painful enough for me. And for the man, he was told, cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. Now notice that the consequences are, in a sense, they're not new things. The woman was always destined to bear children. Chapter 1, God told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, have children. But now God says that's going to be a difficult and painful experience for you. And same thing with work. Given the responsibility to work, but now God says it's going to be difficult and painful. It'll be full of thorns and thistles. And ever since, mankind has struggled with work, struggled to find beauty and meaning. Our hoes and plows into the hard-packed soil as we prick our hands on the thorns on the beautiful roses. These days, of course, most of us don't till the earth. We leave that to others to do. We do other things to earn our living, and we buy the stuff that other people have grown. These days, it's all sorts of other things that cause frustration, like when I was working on my sermon on Friday and my computer decided to freeze and not save what I had done. At one level, I'm cursing Bill Gates. At another level, I'm cursing this broken world that we live in, because in many and various ways we feel the consequences of what God was telling Adam back then. Work will be difficult and frustrating and painful. So what do we do with that? Well, can I suggest two options? Other than simply just go, well, that's the way it is and there's nothing I can do about it. Can I suggest two options? The first is change your work. It sounds a bit facetious, I know, but it's possible. And I know there are people in the room that have done that. Going, you know, the job I'm doing, the work I'm doing is, I'm not suited to me, or the boss is it, whatever it might be, for various reasons, and we can change the work that we do. It's a possibility for us in our day and age. We used to live in a world where you start straight out of school, and maybe you left school early, at year 10 level or whatever it was, and when you got a traineeship or an apprenticeship, or maybe you went to uni and straight out of uni you got a job, and that was where you were and that was what you did for life. My grandfather was a farm labourer. He lived in the same cottage on the same farm where he worked for 60 years. That was what life was like. Today, the world is different. Statistics tell us that the average person changes jobs 10 to 15 times in their working life. That's on average every 3 years. And it's not just jobs we change, it's careers that we change. Again, statistics say on average we undergo 5 to 7 career changes in our working lives. And I've got to say, some of you must be boosting those averages, because I've only had 2 careers thus far, school teacher and clergyman. My point is simply that we can actually change the work that we do. We can say, well, this isn't working out for whatever reason. Maybe I can change it. But even further, frustrated with work, they don't just change their jobs or their careers. They change their whole pattern of living and working. There's a book out at the moment that's been a bestseller called The 4-Hour Work Week by Timothy Ferris. There it is, the new expanded and updated version. I wonder if you reflected on the irony of sitting down to work and writing that book when his whole thesis is you need to get out doing work. Because that's basically his argument. He argues that you can reduce your workload dramatically if you cut back on the meaningless, irrelevant things And if you focus instead on the things that you do best, if you use technology to your benefit, if you focus on your strengths, if you outsource the things that you don't enjoy or you're not good at, he suggests you can whittle it down so you work only 4 hours a week. And along the way, you can amass a fortune, which in turn gives you time to do what your heart desires. I don't know about you, but I'm somewhat cynical about that. I'm not sure that, although it sounds enticing, with this lovely picture on the cover there. See, this is the ideal life. If you look at the picture on the cover, we've got a boat lying there in a hammock between two palm trees. This is the goal. This is what we should all be aiming for, striving for, to be hanging around doing nothing. And he portrays work as an inconvenience, something to be avoided if at all possible. The is a life of leisure, full of good food and fine wine and long naps and no work. Who's living that life? No. Not only is, I think, that unrealistic for most of us, but I actually think it's an unhealthy view of work. Because, as I said last week, work is something we were created to do. It's inherent in our nature. We need to work. It's the way God made us to be, like him. We need to be doing things. We need to be being creative and constructive, to be contributing. I was going to say you wouldn't believe, but you probably would believe the number of people I've talked to retired and gone, going, man, I don't know what to do with myself. I need to be doing something. I think Ferris's four-hour working week is at the extreme end and the unhelpful end of the, if work is frustrating and hard, then just change what you do and end up doing it. But that's one option, is to change what you do. The other option is, don't change what you do, but change your attitude towards what you do. And I quoted last week from Ecclesiastes, we only read a couple of verses, and I want to read those verses again in their broader context. Because I read verses 24 and 25 last week. This time I want to start at verse 20. I haven't put it on the screen, I want the reference, but you can look it up in the Pew Bibles. Ecclesiastes chapter 2 from verse 20, Ecclesiastes writes this, "Turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it." Jesus actually tells a parable very similar to that. I've often wondered if Jesus is echoing Ecclesiastes' words, the parable of the rich fool, man who says, "I've been very clever and successful. I filled up my barns, and I'm going to sit back and eat and drink and be happy and enjoy life." And God says, "You fool, for tonight you will die, and then you will get all these things that you've stored up for yourselves." Ecclesiastes is saying the same thing. He says, "I work hard, I'm clever, I'm smart, I'm wise, I've prospered, but what's going to happen to it? Somebody else will get it." And he says, "This is vanity and a great evil." Verse 22, "What has a man? What do you gain? Well, and striving a heart with which he toils beneath the sun. His days are full of sorrow and his work is a vexation." Interesting to see when you're chatting to someone over morning tea. Someone says, "How is your work?" And you go, "Oh, all my days were full of sorrow and my work was a vexation." "Even in the night, his heart does not rest." Have you experienced that? Not only is work hard all day, but then it keeps you awake at night. And Ecclesiastes says, "This also is vanity." The word there is very hard to capture. It's saying, this is something I cannot grasp the meaning of. It seems futile. I'm chasing the wind. See, Ecclesiastes didn't live in some unrealistic utopia. He lived in the same broken world that you and I live in. He understood, as we all do, that work can be hard and frustrating. And when I talk about work, I'm not just necessarily talking about the office 9 to 5. Some of us haven't got an office job yet. Some of us are, you know, still at school or uni. And I tell you, those 12 hours a week that you spend at uni, that's work. And homework and all that other stuff. And so we sort of left the office behind, but you know what? You're still working, looking after elderly, frail, loved ones, looking after your garden and your house and helping out and working. We all work in various ways. And I think we can all understand exactly what Ecclesiastes was saying when he says, it's vanity, it's hard and frustrating, and what's the point? So what do we do about it? Well, verse 24, the next breath, Ecclesiastes says this, there is nothing better for a person than that he or she should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Go out and quit work. He says, make the most of it. Yes, I know it's hard and it can be frustrating, but you know what? This is what God has given you. Make the most of it. Eat and drink and find enjoyment in your toil. Not away from your toil, but in your toil. Amongst the thorns and the thistles. Make the most of it. It's a similar attitude, I think, to what Paul teaches us in Philippians chapter 4. And again, the reference is on the screen if you want to look it up. Philippians chapter 4, verses 11 and 13. He writes this, I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. See, Paul, like Ecclesiastes, says, I know the hardships of life. I know the thorns and the thistles. I've had plenty and I've had nothing. I've been high and I've been low. And I have learned in whatever situation I'm in how to be content. And how is that? I can do all things through him who strengthens me. He says, my life is in God's hands. And in God's hands and in his grace, whether I have plenty or just a little, I'll rest secure. Not in my own riches, but in God's grace. And with that attitude, he says, I can be content in any situation. I can serve God whatever my circumstance. God's secret ultimately to successful living is not to avoid work with all its thorns and thistles and hardships and its sweat. It's to embrace life and to find beauty and delight and purpose even when you're living among the thorns. It's all to do with the attitude. There's a great story that's told about John F. Kennedy, the President of the United States, who they put the man on the moon, was it 1969? One of my earliest memories, actually, in my childhood, is seeing that on my grandfather's old black and white TV. 8 years before that, because they'd been working towards it for years and years and years, 1961, President John F. Kennedy visited NASA headquarters and was being guided around the facility, and he passed a janitor who was mopping the floor, and he went over and he introduced himself. And he asked the janitor what he did at NASA. And the man replied, I'm helping put a man on the moon. See, many other people have said, I live a meaningless life of mopping floors. It's all pointless. But he said, no, I'm helping put a man on the moon. I'm part of a bigger thing. I can see a bigger vision. My life has meaning and purpose, even though to many people this is a tragedy. It's all in the energy. Do we look at our lives and do we say, I live a meaningless life of drudgery and frustration, or do we see ourselves, to quote from the Blues Brothers, as being on a mission from God? Do you believe that each new day is a day that the Lord has made? I was driving in this morning and there's all sorts of things flying through my head, as I'm sure through there are flying through your heads this morning. There's stuff that's happened at home. There's family issues, there's worrying about people who have been sick and ended up in hospital. As I drove sort of near Mount Kira Road and we were talking about the accident that happened there on Friday. And there's all these things going on in life and in my head. And it's sort of, you feel sort of all this the dark cloud hanging over you of all the stuff that there is to be worried about. And then I looked up and the sky is blue and the trees are beautiful and I thought, God's giving me a new day. A fresh day to live and a fresh day to serve in whatever circumstances he puts me. It's to do with the action. Will you see today, this week, whatever your circumstances, as an opportunity to serve God wherever he has put you? Heavenly Father, we pray thanking you for the opportunity to work, and we do pray for those who would long to work and can't find it, and for those for whom work is hard, frustrating, and disappointing. Dear Lord, we do pray that you help us to find the right balance, the right attitude, in the midst of the thorns and the thistles and the hardships and the vanity and the frustration, to eat, drink, and find enjoyment in our toil, and to know the contentment that comes from knowing that our lives are in your hands, and we are serving you as we pray to you. You know, when you meet someone over morning tea or whatever it is, what's one of the first questions they ask? What do you do? We're defined by what we do. This song reminds us that we're more than that, and who God says we are. So let's stand.
There was a young couple who bought an old, run-down, abandoned farm. The fields were overgrown with weeds, the farmhouse was falling apart, the fences were broken down, and at their housewarming party, their farm-warming party, their minister prayed for them along these lines: "May you and God work together to make this the farm of your dreams." A few months later, the minister dropped in to see how things were going, and he couldn't believe his eyes. The farmhouse was completely rebuilt. There was livestock happily munching on good food in well-fenced pens. The fields were full of crops all planted out in neat rows, just like your backyard, in fact. "This is amazing," said the minister. "My prayers have been answered. Look what you and God have accomplished together." And the farmer said, "Well, yes, but don't forget what it was like when God was looking after it on his own. We're looking at what the Bible has to say about work. And today we're going to think about how we are called to work for God in everything, whether that be in the temple or in the cowshed." We read from Exodus chapter 31. And Exodus, of course, is the story of how God rescues Israel from their slavery in Egypt, leads them across the Red Sea, through the desert, to the promised land, the land that he had promised their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And along the way, they stop at Mount Sinai. Exodus chapter 19, they arrive at Mount Sinai, and Moses goes up the mountain. And the bit that everybody knows is that Moses came down from the mountain with the two stone tablets with the Ten Commandments on it, unless you've seen the right video clip and you know that actually he had three tablets with 15 commandments but dropped one of them. But Moses didn't just get given the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. In fact, there's a huge slab of Exodus from chapter 20 onwards, right through the passage we're looking at, chapter 31 and beyond, where Moses spends 40 days on the mountain communing with God and being given all sorts of instructions about a whole range of things, including the instructions for building the tabernacle, or the sanctuary, as it's mentioned there on the screen in chapter 25. The tabernacle, or the sanctuary, was a tent where Israel could meet with God. Although to call it a tent would be a little bit like calling the opera house a shed. Forget that little two-man tent that you put up when you go camping. This was a massive complex. It covered what used to be the standard building block in Australia, a quarter acre. And at the centre of it stood the holy place, and at the heart of that was the Holy of Holies, in which there was the Ark of the Covenant and all sorts of other precious things. And the whole thing was decorated with expensive fabric, the most expensive fabrics, indigo, purple, scarlet, very hard dyes to make and to buy. And it was decorated with all those precious items made of gold and silver and bronze. In fact, if you add it all up, there were 7 tons of precious metals alone. It took, when the whole thing was finished, and every time they moved camp, they had to pack this thing up and move it and reset it up at the heart of the new camp, it took 5,900 able-bodied Levites to carry the thing. And you thought you had trouble fitting your camping gear in the back of your car. It was really quite impractical. It was, in fact, a very impractical thing for a bunch of slaves running away through the desert, first to make and then to carry. But the point is, it wasn't meant to be practical. It was meant to be glorious. It was meant to reflect the power and the glory of the living God with whom they met in that place. And so it had to be grand in scale. And it had to have the best materials. And it had to have the most gifted of builders. And so we read in chapter 31 about the appointment of Bezalel. And the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God, with ability and intelligence, with knowledge and all craftsmanship, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold and silver and bronze, in cutting stones for setting, in carving wood, to work in every craft," and so on. See what God's saying? Saying, I didn't just want a competent job done. I want an outstanding job done. "So I have not only chosen Bezalel, but I have filled him with my Spirit, with all these things, ability, intelligence, knowledge, craftsmanship, artistic ability, so that he can do a great work for my glory." As you know, because I've mentioned it many times, I grew up in Kenya, in East Africa, in the highlands of Kenya. Most people sort of go, oh yeah, Kenya, Nairobi, been there. Nowhere near Nairobi, the highlands of Kenya, a little place called Turi. You'd struggle to find it on the map. There's not much there. There's a little village surrounded by farmlands. It's fertile farming area, and a school, St. Andrew's School, Turi, which I went to primary school for. My parents worked there. In fact, later on, when I had a gap year after school, I went back and worked there myself, which made a second generation, actually a third generation, because my grandparents had worked there as well. Back in the 1950s, my grandfather was actually the deputy head, and they worked with the couple that had built the school with a view to taking over the running of the school when they retired. Unfortunately, my grandfather had passed away before that could happen. I'll come to that in a minute. The school were a couple called, everybody knew them as Ma and Pa. Ma and Pa Lavers they were, a bit like Ma and Pa Kettle. There are generations of students that went to that school that loved and revered Pa. Anyway, as I said, my grandfather passed away. Ma Lavers passed away. And one of the strongest memories from my childhood is of the day that my grandmother got remarried to Pa. And so he became my step-grandfather. And he was a real character. In fact, I was in the vestry earlier, and as David Mansfield's book about John Chapman. You know, John Chapman, those who know him, he was a great storyteller. Pa was a character like that. He was one of life's great storytellers, larger than life, filled a room, told these most amazing stories. You suspected they were often a little embellished, but they were great stories. And one of the stories I'll never forget, I heard it many times, was of the day the school burnt down. Ma and Pa had laboured and built this school. As I said, it's fertile country. They're surrounded by the school owns its own forest, and they'd cut down trees and they built the school. And then one day there was a little fire in the kitchen, which spread to the walls of the kitchen, which soon spread to the whole of the rest of the school because it was all built out of wood, and the whole thing burnt down, except for the chapel, interestingly. And I remember Pa talking about the day, the middle of the night, as they, because it was a boarding school, all the staff and all the students were out on the football field, which was the only place that was cleared and safe, watching the school burn down around them. And he said, "I prayed and I had to work out what to do." And he said, "Well, there's only one thing to do. We'll rebuild." Now, this was in the days of the Second World War. And just down the road, there was a prisoner of war camp full of Italian prisoners of war. And Pa went down and he spoke to the commander of the camp and asked for permission to speak to the prisoners of war. And having the gift of the gab as he did, I don't know how he did it, but he managed to persuade those prisoners that they would much rather spend their days doing something constructive and helping rebuild the school than sitting there in the prisoner of war camp doing nothing. So out they came, these Italian prisoners of war, and they helped rebuild the school. But they didn't just rebuild it as it was. They were determined that it would be bigger and better than it ever was before. So instead of rebuilding out of timber again, they built the school out of stone this time. It's a bit like the Three Little Pigs, isn't it? But not. They quarried the stone, they built these buildings, and they went the extra mile. Like when they painted the inside of the dormitories, they didn't just whitewash the walls, they decorated them with pictures. In the boys' dormitories, there were cars and boats and things. In the girls' dormitories, there were fairy tales. I remember Snow White and the Seven Dwarves and so on. They went the extra mile. Then when it came to the school hall, they said to Pa, "What do you want it to be like?" And he said, "I don't know, a hall, walls and a roof." And they said, "Oh, yeah, but okay, I'll tell you what, we will build it like the town hall back home in Italy." And so they set out and they built this hall. So this little school barely a dot on the map in the middle of Africa, in the middle of nowhere, has this hall modelled on a town hall in this town back in Italy. It's got 2-foot-thick stone walls. It's got these massive vaulted cathedral ceilings. It's got parquetry floor. All the parquetry is individually cut and laid by these prisoners of war. It's just magnificent. I don't know what motivated them to build the way they did and to go above and beyond what they needed to do. I suspect it was personal pride. If I'm going to do a job, I'm going to do it well. What drove the builders of the tabernacle was a burning desire, not just to bring credit to themselves, but to bring glory to God. And that same attitude should drive us too. Of course, we're not building a tabernacle. We will hopefully be building a new hall. And this principle has some application there. I'm not suggesting we have 2-foot-thick stone walls. I don't think we'd have enough room. But we should. There are principles there about we should be doing the best we can to serve God and bring credit to him in this place. But I want to go beyond that. Because the Bible tells us that it's not just when we're building tabernacles or churches that we should do the best we can to bring glory to God. It's in everything that we do. So we read that second reading from Colossians chapter 3 this morning. And Paul wrote, did you notice who he was addressing? Bond servants is the phrase that is. Some translations have slaves. These were people who were either actually literally slaves, being taken captive and forced to work, or they were technically servants. They had a job they were paid to do, but their conditions were so poor that they might as well have been called slaves. They were impoverished. They were trapped in that situation. They were lowly paid. These were the house servants. These were the housemaids, the stable hands, the farm labourers. These were not people who were building a temple for God's glory. These were people who were doing menial jobs in someone else's house. But Paul still said to them in Colossians 3:22, "Bondservants, obey everything those who are your earthly masters." So obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. When he talks about eye service there, what he means is the service that you give when you're being watched. That is, don't just do a good job while your master is watching. But the second his back's turned, you're going to put down your broom and go back to gossiping with the cook. Or in modern terms, don't just diligently when the boss happens to walk through the office, and then the second she's gone, you go back to playing solitaire. Work hard, diligently, all the time. Why? Paul says, because you're not just working for the boss, you're working for God. And it's not just your paycheck, if you get one at the end of the week, that you should have your eyes on. It's your eternal heavenly reward that you should have your eyes fixed. See what Paul's saying? He's saying it's not just those who are specially selected and committed to serving God. It's not just those who are building the temple. It's not just apostles like Paul. It's not just the preachers and the evangelists who are working for God's glory. It's everyone. It's the bond servants in a household who are working to serve God. In the Middle Ages in Europe, there was this huge gap, this huge divide between what was regarded as sacred work and what was regarded as secular work. Sacred work was work that was holy dedicated and pleasing to God. That was what the priests and the monks and the nuns did as they said their prayers and sang their hymns in the churches and monasteries and nunneries. The secular work, that was the man digging in the muddy field and the cook slaving over a hot fire in the kitchen and the boy feeding the pigs out in the cold, that was secular work which had no value to God. But the reformers, part of one of the key things that was discovered, rediscovered in the Reformation, is as the reformers like Martin Luther and John Calvin and others, as they studied their Bibles and read passages like the one in Colossians chapter 3, as they studied their Bibles, they realized that they'd had it all wrong. That actually all of us are called to serve God wherever we are. So let me quote to you something Martin Luther, for example, wrote. He wrote this: "The idea that service to God should have only to do with a church altar, singing, reading, sacrifice and the like, is without doubt the worst trick of the devil. How could the devil have led us more effectively astray than by the narrow conception that service to God takes place only in the church and by works done therein?" He goes on to say, the whole world could abound with services to the Lord, not only in churches, but also in the home, kitchen, workshop, field. See, we're not just serving God when we're in church. We're called to serve him all the time, wherever you are. You're working for God just as much when you're sitting at your desk, when you're looking after your children or someone else's children, minding the grandkids. You're serving God every bit as much when you do that as when you're singing in the choir. There is no divide between the sacred and the secular. The whole of life, you're working for. Somebody at the early service this morning told me a story about a lady. Churches used to have grandiose signs at the front that would say, "Divine service held here 3 times a day. There's divine service, you know. It's not just we get together, we hold divine service. It's a glorifying to God thing. He said, well, he saw a lady once who had a sign up over the sink in the kitchen that said, "Divine service held here 3 times a day. So it's not just when you're in church, it's when you're doing the dishes. You're serving God in everything. And Paul urges us to understand that just as Bezalel and the others who built the tabernacle dedicated themselves to building something that reflected and honoured the glory of God, so we should honour him in everything that we do. So they built with precious cloth and with gold and silver. What are you building? Honesty, integrity, loyalty, hard work, creativity? Do people look at your life and say, there's a monument to God's glory? One of the greatest composers of all time was Johann Sebastian Bach. And you can see there a piece of his music that he wrote in his handwriting. And you can see that at the bottom he's signed his name. And can you see what's above it? SDG, which is short for Soli Deo Gloria, Latin for to the glory of God alone. See what he's saying? Well, I wrote this manuscript, not so that you can give me credit and I can feel good that you all think I'm wonderful, but for God's glory. Do you do that? Well, maybe you don't write music, but you do you do that in other things that you do? At work, you work out that complicated spreadsheet? Do you type SDG down the bottom? Maybe not. But do you think it at least? Do you go, I'm doing this for God's glory? When you're looking after your grandkids and you change that nappy, do you get a little texter out and write SDG across the bottom? I did this for the glory of God. Maybe not literally, but do you do everything that you do for God's glory? Think back. Would God be happy that the week you just lived was dedicated to him? Would God be happy for you to say, yes, what I did on Friday night, that was for God. That conversation I had around the water cooler on Tuesday morning at work, that was for God's glory? Or would he be embarrassed? Let me read to you those words again from Colossians 3 that we read earlier. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord, not for men, that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving. So it was a taxi driver who arrived at the pearly gates, and St. Peter greeted him with enthusiasm and with open arms. He embraced him and he gave him a beautiful flowing silk robe to wear and a terrific golden staff to carry around with him. Right behind him in the queue was a priest. When he stepped forward, St. Peter frowned and he gave him an old, worn, torn, tatty robe and a wooden staff to carry. And the priest got all upset and he said, "Hang on a second, how come the taxi driver gets the silk robe and the golden staff and all I get is this rubbish?" And St. Peter said, "Well, yes, you had very different jobs, but the truth of the matter is that when you preached, people slept. When he drove, people prayed. I don't think we've got any taxi drivers in the room. But when is it true of you that when you go to work, the effect that you have on people is that you turn them to prayer? Not in a bad way, necessarily. Should you aim to encourage people to pray? Should you aim to tell people about Jesus at work? When a Christian goes to work, should they leave their faith behind them or take it with them?" This is a question that's very current in our society, particularly given the situation with Israel Folau. I assume even if you're not a rugby supporter that you've heard of this in the news. Israel Folau had his contract with Rugby Australia torn up after he posted comments on Instagram that were deemed by some to be offensive, particularly to homosexuals, although he actually targeted at lots of people, caught for wrongful dismissal, and it will be interesting to see where that ends. In all the debate around that, some people have suggested that as a good Christian, Israel Folau should have turned the other cheek, sucked it up, was one phrase that was used by a Christian commentator this week, and not made the fuss that he has and taken it as far as he has. But I actually think that, he's got good biblical basis to do it, and B, he's actually doing us a community service. Let me take the first point first, and that is biblical precedent. The Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 25 is in Caesarea, and the local Jews, or maybe not even locals, are people that have come into town following him, looking to cause trouble for him, have accused him wrongly of various false things, and he's been locked up, and he's taken before the new governor, Festus, and Paul realises that such is the antagonism towards him and his faith and his preaching that he is not likely to get a fair hearing. And so what does he do? He says, famously, in Acts 25:11, "I appeal to Caesar." That is, in the Roman Empire, any Roman citizen, wherever they were in the empire, had the right to say, as a Roman citizen, "I have the right and I appeal to my right to be taken to Rome and have my case heard before Caesar in Rome." That is, "I do not trust this court," or whatever the reason may be, "I want to have my case heard by the highest authority there is in Rome in front of Caesar." See? He appealed to his rights. He appealed to the highest legal authority there was. So I think Israel Folau has good biblical grounds for saying, "Well, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to appeal to my rights. I'm going to go to court and test what my rights are." The second thing I want to say is I'm glad he's doing it, although it's going to be a hard time for him, because I think it's important that the law on this get tested. And this could well be a test case that helps define what all of our rights at work are. As I said, though, however, we won't know the outcome of that case for quite some time. The sad thing is, even if Israel Folau wins, I suspect by the time the court cases are all finished, he'll be past retiring age for a football player. Set that case aside for the moment, and let's ask the broader question. As Christians, should we take our faith to work with us? And how do we do that? What does that look like? And I want to look at this in various ways. And the first thing I simply want to say is, well, of course you should take your faith with you. I hope you take your faith with you everywhere you go, because God goes with you everywhere that you go, doesn't he? Psalm 139, I'll read a few verses. That's one of them in verse 7. Verse 7 says, "Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. it doesn't say, but when I'm at the office, you have to stay outside and wait for me to come out again. The psalmist says, quite rightly, everywhere I go, you are there. Even if I try and hide from you, I can't get away from you. So no Christian should be saying, well, I leave God behind when I go to work. God ought to be an inextricable part of your life. You can't be a part-time Christian any more than you can be partially pregnant. You either are or you aren't. It's a good question to ask, what does that look like? How do I do that? How do I take my faith to work? And I want to look at it actually through the eyes of Peter. We read a passage from 1 Peter 3. I actually want to start the chapter before, chapter 2. There's two passages in chapter 2 and 3 of Peter that have some very helpful advice for us, I think. Well, not just advice, instruction. And the first is in 1 Peter chapter 2. It's a verse I've often quoted, but I think it bears repeating again and again. 1 Peter 2:12, Peter tells us we have to be God's person in the workplace. He writes this, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honourable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. See what he's saying? Live honourable lives. In a world that is often antagonistic towards you, live in such a way as to bring glory to God. Now, what is an honourable life? What does that look like? What good deeds is he talking about? Well, that may vary from person to person and context to context. But it has to at least, doesn't it, have to include things like integrity, honesty, hard work, generosity, love, awareness of the needs of others. In fact, I could go on and on and on, but actually to make it a little bit easier, you can read, I've put this on a piece of paper that you received as you came in. And I'm not claiming credit for that. I did research, as you do, and found ideas from lots of people, and I just sort of compiled them into this list. I hope that is some help to you, some advice on how it is that you live that out. What does it look like to live an honourable life, a life of good deeds that glorify God in the workplace? I commend that to you. Interestingly, if I can go back to the Israel Folau situation just briefly for a moment, those who say, well, I'm offended by what he said, well, actually, to be fair, offended by what God says, because he quoted the Bible. And it's interesting, isn't it? People that say they don't believe in God and they don't believe in hell are suddenly offended at being told God says you're going to hell. But apart from the offence over that, one of the things that people have said time and again is friends, teammates, and so on, is that he's a really nice. He's not a wife beater. He's not a drug dealer. He's not a cheat. So he obviously doesn't belong in rugby league. Everyone who has ever spoken about him, apart from their offence at what he said, says he's a lovely, softly spoken, kind and generous. Friends, I hope that should it ever happen that you come under attack at work for your faith, that at the very least people will be saying, well, I've always found him or her to be a really kind and loving and generous and trustworthy. That's our first calling in the workplace. And when I say the workplace, I'm not just necessarily talking about the office that you go to between 9 and 5 on Monday. It might be anywhere that you go where you're engaged with other people outside of this building. It might be at uni, it might be in the bowling club, it might be in the golf club, it might be in the Rotary, it might be anywhere where you go and you're engaging with other people who are not necessarily Christian in a context that isn't church. I would say you're representing God out in the world and you need to be God's person in that context. And the more you are God's person in that context, the more likely it is that you will earn the right to be God's spokesperson in that context. And so we come to the next chapter, 1 Peter chapter 3, and we read it earlier. Peter said, but in your hearts, honour Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defence to anyone who asks you for the reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you're slandered, those who revile your good behaviour in Christ may be put to shame. Much of that echoes what he said in the previous chapter about keeping a good conscience, doing it with gentleness and respect so that people will notice your good behaviour. But note, the key thing he says that's new in chapter 3 is always being prepared to make a defence. The word that he uses there in the Greek is the word apologia, from which we get the English word apologetics, which I don't know about you, when I first got told that we had to learn apologetics as Christians, I thought, what does that mean? Feeling embarrassed about our faith, saying, sorry, oops, sorry, it's a bit embarrassing, I know. No, apologetics, apologia, is a word that means a word in reply, literally. You ever met anybody that just always has a response to whatever you say? That's not always a good thing. But in this case, Peter says, in a good way, always be prepared to have a word in reply, a response, a defence for your faith. Now, witnessing in the world in general, and particularly at workplace, is a tricky thing. There will be people say you can't, you don't do it, you shouldn't do it. And there are times when it is inappropriate to do what we used to call cold calling, just to walk up to someone out of the blue and say, do you know Jesus? I can see some complaints going to human resources about that in some workplaces at least. Sometimes it can be hard and would be maybe inappropriate to do that. But what all of us can do is answer a question when it gets asked. What all of us can do is make a defence to anyone who asks us for a reason for the hope that is in us. Now you might say, well, why would somebody ask me that question? And I think Peter would say, because they've been watching you, because they've been listening to you, because they've seen your good deeds, because they've seen your honourable life. They've seen something in you that intrigues them or puzzles them or impresses them, and they trust you and they will ask you a question. They will want to know more. They say in rugby, and apologies to those who are not rugby supporters, but I'm afraid you're going to have to get over it because it is the game they play in heaven. So you're going to have to learn all about it. I just hope Israel Folau's on my team. They say in rugby that you have to earn the right to throw the ball around. You'll hear commentators say that sometimes, you know, that someone's got the ball and they're throwing wild passes and it's not working. Saying, well, you have to earn the right to throw the ball around. What does that mean? Well, it means that before you get to that marvellous moment, you know, in the last minute, switching games slightly for a moment, in the last minute of the State of Origin game on Wednesday night, when Mitchell Pearce throws that beautiful pass and it goes out to Trebojevic, who throws it to, who was on the wing? There was Blake Ferguson, who then tosses it back inside he plays for the Roosters, never mind. Try, and even if you haven't watched rugby league, you probably saw it on the news at some point. Before you get to those marvellous, magical moments where you throw that beautiful pass and someone takes the ball and flies downfield and scores in the corner, before you get to that that glorious moment that's going to be played on the news, there's a lot of hard work that has gone into getting into that position in the first. You have to have earned the right to be there and do that. What do I mean by that? Well, before the glorious moment, the glamorous moment, there are an awful lot of unglamorous along the way. There's all those big, boofy forwards sticking their heads time and again into piles of sweaty bodies trying to get the ball. There's the poor little halfback throwing his tiny, weeny little body in the way of a 150-kilogram giant storming down the field to try and stop him. And even before you've run onto the field, there are the countless hours in the gym and on the training paddock and in the hospital recovering from the last game. And it's only after all that hard, unglamorous work has been done that you've laid the groundwork and you've got yourself in a position to be there, you've earned the right to throw that pass and send the guy storming downfield and get the glamorous. And I think it's like that with sharing the gospel, particularly at work. You have to have earned the right to be in that. Before you get to the point where you can say, let me tell you about Jesus, you have to have earned respect. You have to have modelled integrity. You have to have lived a life that's noticeably different. And then maybe, just maybe, that moment will come when someone says, tell me, what is it that makes you different? What is it that makes you... And that's your moment. And away you go. Or hopefully, away you go. Because what you don't want to happen in that moment is to be left mumbling because you don't know what to say. That would be like you throwing that beautiful pass floating out towards the winger and he fumbles it and drops it. I think every Christian ought to learn a basic gospel outline, some way of sharing the gospel so that when that moment comes, you know what to say. What to say, talk to Janine after this. She will train you. Others can train you as well. There's a range of methods and techniques and outlines that you can use, but make sure you have learned it somehow so that when someone says, please tell me about Jesus, you can go, I'm glad you asked, and away you go. The other thing that you should also learn, well, it's not hard to learn because it's your life story, but prepare, how would you say it, is your testimony. Because it's actually more likely that someone's going to tell me about yourself. And you can give your testimony. You can say how your life has unfolded, how you came to be the person you are, and what part Jesus played in that. But even before that moment of evangelism, sharing the gospel, comes the apologetics that I think Peter is talking about. He says, be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks. What sorts of questions are they going to ask? Let's be honest, they're not likely to say, please tell me how I can be saved. They're more likely to say, you're a Christian, aren't you? What do you think about this thing that's been in the news? And we need to be thinking Christians. We need to be paying attention to what is going on in the news, to what is going on in the world, what people are talking about. And we need to be constantly thinking, what do I think about that? Say about that? How would I respond if somebody asks me about that at work tomorrow? So that when that moment comes, you have something to say. In fact, I'm going to put you to the test right here, right now. I'll go back to something I've talked about already, Israel Folau. You're at work tomorrow and someone says to you, you're a Christian, what do you think about this whole Israel Folau thing? What are you going to say that is honouring to God, faithful, true and helpful in that situation? You've got 2 minutes, turn to the person next to you. They have just said to you, what do you think about this whole Israel Folau thing? What are you going to say? Go on, take a couple of minutes and see what you might come up with. Okay, folks, I'll let you off the hook there. But can I say, this is an artificial situation, and you're talking to friends and you're talking to people who it's fairly likely share your point of view. But if this was work tomorrow morning and you were talking to one of your work colleagues, who would find that conversation easy? Who would know what to say? Yeah? Not enough hands went up, brothers and sisters. It's hard, I know, but it is what will happen. Not necessarily over Folau, but over a multitude of other things. Your first point of contact with someone and being able to talk about your faith is not likely to be, please tell me about it. It's most likely to be, what do you think about that? Why do you believe that? And Peter says you've always got to be prepared to make a defence, to give a word in reply, to answer for you. We need to be thinking. We need to be thinking about the issues going on and how we respond to them, the questions people ask and how we reply. And it may only be that after some time has passed and you have answered a number of questions on a range of topics that you may be able to get to the point of being able to say, let me tell you, taking your faith to work is a tricky business. But here are 3 points that I've tried to give you this morning. And the first is simply don't leave God at home. He goes everywhere with you, doesn't he? I hope your workmates, if they walked in the door this morning, wouldn't go, oh my goodness, I had no idea. Be God's person in every situation. And if you are God's person faithfully and well, you might earn the right to be spokesperson, in which case, be prepared. Well, that was the tradition in Jesus' day. Everyone stood and the speaker sat. I just need a high chair. Chair sounds so mundane. Throne. So there was a business owner who decided to move his business from a shop in the main street into the nearby shopping mall. A few of his friends were a bit sceptical about whether this was a wise move or not. So one friend decided to encourage him and sent him some flowers on opening day. The flowers arrived and the business owner opened the cards, and the card accompanying the flowers said, rest in peace. A little upset, he rang his friend to ask what he meant by this, and the friend said, oh, there's some mix-up, and rang the florists, who apologised profusely for the mix-up, and they said, but what's even more concerning is, there's a funeral taking place out there somewhere today that has flowers with a note that says, congratulations on your new location. Rest in peace is the classic inscription on a card for a funeral or on a headstone. And it reflects the biblical teaching that when a person passes away and goes to heaven, they have entered into God's rest. We even quote the verse from Revelation at the end of a funeral service. Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord henceforth, for they shall rest from their labours. We've been looking at what the Bible has to say about work over the last few weeks. Today we finish that series, and the final word belongs not with work, but with rest. God commands his people in the Old Testament to rest. It's the fourth of the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20, verses 8 to 11, say this: "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock or the sojourner who was within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." And it's quoting, of course, referring to Genesis. I was encouraged by, actually, in that reading from Hebrews that we'll come to shortly. Did you notice how it went? For it says somewhere, God rested on the seventh day. You go, well, yeah, it's Genesis chapter 2. Surely you knew that. I'm encouraged that even the scriptural writers at times went, I know it's there somewhere. This fourth commandment is actually the longest of the Ten Commandments, if you look at the amount of space on the page it takes up. And I can't help wondering if that's not because God knew that it was going to be the hardest one for his people to get their head around. Not necessarily hardest to do, love God with all your heart, that's pretty, but to understand what God meant by this and to whom it applied. And I think part of that is we often feel guilty about resting, but God tells us to. And I think there are two reasons for that. The first is, it's good for us to take a break occasionally. Even here in Australia, where we have this reputation that we are fairly laid back, and we like to pride ourselves on our laid back lifestyle, a life of endless barbecues and days spent on the beach. I know that's what you've all been doing. The truth is that in a recent study of 23 countries, Australia ranked amongst the worst in terms of long working hours, occupational stress, and poor work-life balance. We like to think we're relaxed and laid back, but we actually work as hard as anyone. And it's not good for us. Not saying work is bad, but it's not good for us to work and not rest. You may have heard, I'm sure you have heard, the story of the young man who applied for and got a job as a tree cutter. On his first day, on the Monday of his first week, he cut down more trees than anyone. The boss was very pleased. The second day, he didn't cut down quite as many, but still more than anyone else. But as the week went on, his numbers began to drop. Until on Friday afternoon, his boss came and saw him and said, "Listen, mate, we're going to have to do something. Otherwise, you're going to lose your job. Because your numbers were terrific on the beginning of the week, but as of this morning, you're way behind everyone else. What's going on?" And the young man said, "I don't know. I'm working just as hard as I was at the beginning of the week. I arrive first, I leave last. Last couple of days, I've even worked through my lunch break." And the boss said, "How often do you stop and sharpen your axe?" And the young man said, "I don't have time for that." We all need to take time out to sharpen our axe, to refresh ourselves. We need to spend time away from work. We need to spend time with our families. We need to spend time fishing, or gardening, or playing golf, or knitting, or doing jigsaw puzzles, or whatever it is that you do to relax. It's important for our physical and our mental health. But more than being a day for us, of course, the day of rest was supposed to be a day for God, a day to nurture not just our mental and physical health, but our spiritual. Because the Sabbath was that it was a day for God, a holy day. God said, a day dedicated to him. That's a funny thing, isn't it? Because isn't every day supposed to be dedicated to God? Why do we make it one day a week? Well, you might say the same thing about Mother's Day, for example. Surely our mothers are important to us and loved by us and appreciated by us every day. Doesn't stop us taking one day a year to remember that and reflect on that and recognize that. In the same way, every day, yes, belongs to God, is dedicated to him, but it serves us well to take one day a week and remind ourselves of that, and to mark that, to reflect on who God is, and also to remind us that we're not in control of God. We tend to think that we're indispensable, that it's we who run things and make things happen. And sometimes stopping can be a sobering thing. Have you ever had a day off work, maybe gone to a conference or maybe been sick or something, let alone a few days off, and you come back and nobody even noticed that you were gone. It's a bit humbling, isn't it? You go, oh my goodness, I can not be here and everything just carries on as normal. The world didn't fall apart. Well, I think taking a day of rest serves that purpose too. When we stop, the sun still comes up in the morning. The world still spins on its axis. The rain falls and all those things happen because it's not us that make it happen. It's God. And stopping and reflecting on the fact that he is in control and resting in his arms rather than rushing around trying to take care of everything ourselves is ultimately, of course, rest, as with all good things, can get twisted and distorted and become a burden rather than a blessing. And over the centuries, Jewish scholars, a good desire to define what the Sabbath was and what work was and what you can and can't do, built fences around it, hedges around it, laws that define for you what you were and weren't allowed to do, what qualified as work and what that meant you couldn't do. But this catalogue of laws became so big it became a burden on this day. So, for example, winnowing is, of course, work. Winnowing is that process of separating the wheat from the chaff. Well, what is that? That's separating edible food from inedible. So that is not just, you know, wheat and chaff. That would cover picking out fish bones from your fish. Can't do that on the Sabbath day. Filtering water. Can't do that on the Sabbath day. Also on the Sabbath day, you're not allowed to light a fire. Well, think about all the things that might constitute lighting a fire. You can't drive a car. Think of the spark plugs. You can't go in a lift. Think of the coal-fired power station that is powering it. The fridge, because you will turn the light on inside, making little man on his spinning wheel in there that makes it work. So far from being a day of joyful celebration, the Sabbath became, for the Jews, and you read the Gospels and Jesus talks about this, it became a hardship. Often came under attack for healing on the Sabbath, or even on one occasion allowing his disciples as they walked through a field to pick grain and pop it in their mouths, because of course that's harvesting and you can't do that on the Sabbath. And Jesus responded to that in Mark chapter 2 verse 27 with these words, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." That is, God gave us this day as a day of rest, as a day to reflect on and nurture our relationship with him, and it was supposed to be a blessing for us, not a burden. Now, you come to the New Testament, and some people have noted that of the Ten Commandments, the day of rest is the only one that is not specifically repeated. You can find in the Gospels, elsewhere in the New Testament, specific instructions that echo the Ten Commandments, except for this one. So some people go, well, we don't have to keep that. I would say, well, without being legalistic about it, I think for all the reasons God gave it to Israel in the Old Testament, and it was a good idea, it's still a good idea for us. I'm not going to come round and knock on your door and say, have you had your day of rest? Did you open the fridge today? But I do encourage you to take the time for all those good reasons. But when we think about rest, when Israel thought about rest, it wasn't just that one day at the end of a working week that they looked forward to. They longed for another kind of rest that was just a pointer toward. They longed for the end of the journey when they were on the Exodus, when they would enter the promised land and settle down into that land flowing with milk and honey and rest. Repeatedly, God spoke to them about the promised land as a place where they would settle down and rest and enter his rest, a place of peace and blessing under God's care. It didn't work out that way. They entered the promised land, but it wasn't entirely restful as an experience. And God explained that in Psalm 95, which that passage we had from Hebrews reflected on. Because Israel failed, not because God failed, but because Israel failed, because they distrusted him. And so God swore, as Psalm 95 verse 11 tells us, God swore in his wrath, "They shall not enter my rest." They entered the land, but they didn't experience the rest that God had promised. And so the writer to the Hebrews says, well, that's true, but God's promises don't fail. Therefore, the rest is still waiting. The hope of entering God's rest still remains. And so then says in Hebrews 4, 9 and 10, for example, "So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works, as God did from his." It's talking about not that patch of land in the Middle of East, in the Middle East that we call Israel. It's talking about heaven. That's where true rest will be found, in the presence of God. Because true rest is not found in taking a day off and doing nothing. True rest is not found in switching off your phone and forcing yourself not to check your emails, although those are good things to do. True rest is not found in gardening or watching movies or washing the car or whatever it is that you do on your day of rest. True rest is found in the presence of God, because rest is more than not working. Rest is about being at peace. It's about being feeling warm and loved and secure. We talk, for example, about babies resting in their mother's arms. I woke up early this morning and I thought I'd watch the rugby from last night. Wallabies playing South Africa. That was a mistake, both me watching it and them playing. And at some point halfway through the game, Riley appeared and he came and sat on my lap and for a while there watched the game with me. And I had flashbacks, because when he was about 6 months old, Riley was being a bit obstreperous on a Sunday afternoon, and I was sitting watching probably some game of football, and his mother, in desperation, brought him to me and plonked him on my lap and said, "There, look after your grandson." And within 3 minutes, he was asleep. And for a long time after that, whenever he wouldn't go to sleep, Riley would get parked on my lap and I'd practice my sermon on him and off he'd go. I don't think it was actually the sermons or the football or whatever else we might have been watching. I think it was I like to think that it was the fact that he felt comforted, warm, secure. We find rest when we feel warm and secure and loved and at peace. That's what rest is, and that's what heaven will be. Eternal rest in the presence of God. But we don't just have to wait for heaven to experience that. We can experience some of it now. We read from Matthew chapter 11 where Jesus said, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for you. Come to me and I will give you." He's not talking, ultimately he's talking about heaven. He's the one that will get us there and be there with us, but he's talking in the here and now as well. "Come to me with all your burdens," he says. "Come in the midst of the chaos that your children have caused at home. Come with your concerns about your future at work. Come with your worry over your mother who seems to be losing her memory, and your stress over putting your parents into a nursing home, and all those other things." Jesus says, "Come to me with all your burdens and I will give you," because peace and rest are found in the arms of your Saviour. Do you know that rest?